Hey there, Southern Fried listeners. I just wanted to thank all of you for your patience and also for all of your love and support through my ordeal. I've had so many kind people reach out to me, and I can't tell you how much it meant to me. I thought I understood the danger of sepsis, and yet I still kept thinking I would recover faster. I still need one more back surgery, and I am still on strong antibiotics, so I don't want to make promises about a regular schedule. But I am going to do the best I can to provide content whenever I can. Follow me on social media or check my website, and I will continue to post updates about my schedule. Again, I cannot thank you enough for your support. Even when I was too sick to answer emails or social media tags, I did see your well wishes, and you truly helped me during a very dark time. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The saying, "blood is thicker than water," is often misunderstood in popular culture. It is a medieval proverb dating back to the 12th century that we have twisted over time to suit our own views as needed. Many people believe the phrase means that family bonds outweigh other relationships, but the truth is in the full saying. The blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb. In other words, blood shed while in battle makes for a closer connection between soldiers than that of family ties. In the 1990s, Benton County, Tennessee, and the surrounding areas were terrorized by the greedy, ruthless, and unscrupulous actions of one family, who were bonded by more than just their family name. Their criminal history and penchant for violence created an evil covenant that transcended family ties, including a family friend in their deadly schemes. And their depravity caused the blood of at least two innocent people to be spilled in Northwest Tennessee. Welcome to episode 109, The Bloody Bruces. The city of Camden, located in Benton County, Tennessee, sits 30 miles south of the Kentucky border along the western side of the Tennessee River. The city is characterized first by being the site of a deadly plane crash that took the lives of country music star Patsy Cline, Cowboy Copas, Hawkshaw Hawkins, and their pilot, Randy Hughes, on March 5, 1963. The city's second claim to notoriety is its mussel shelling industry, which was once America's hub for shelling and pearl culturing. Now a dying trade, imparts to technology, outsourcing, and pearl culturing, mussel diving back in the early 90s attracted blue-collar workers to the area, hoping to collect and sell the mussels to wholesalers across the South. Mussel shelling, especially in the muddy Tennessee River, is hard work. In 1990, divers could expect to make a couple of thousand dollars off of a large enough batch of the shells, good money for the residents in Camden. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. On January 16, 1991, the Camden Fire Department responded to a call about a house fire just outside of town. By the time they had arrived, the house was already engulfed in flames, and due to its remote location in the woods, the firefighters decided to let the home burn itself out. The homeowner, Danny Vine, drove a pickup truck that was nowhere to be found on the property, leaving the responding firefighters to believe Danny must not have been home. Instead, a car belonging to Danny's fiance, Della Jean Thornton, was parked near the home. The keys were still in the ignition. The responders worked under the assumption that Danny and Della had left in his truck and that no one was home at the time of the fire. The next day, Larry and Carol Vine were alerted by a friend of their son's that Danny's home had burned down. There was little left of the home other than portions of the front porch. As members of Danny's family arrived, they began sifting through the remains of the property, only for Danny's own brothers to make a shocking discovery in the debris and rubble: human bones. That's when the sheriff's department got involved. Little more than a skull and teeth were found, and the skeletal remains were sent to the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, where a group of forensic anthropologists analyzed the bones. It was determined that the remains were from two separate people. Forensic scientists on the case used dental records to identify the victims: 27-year-old Danny Vine and 29-year-old Della Thornton. Danny and Della were getting married in just a few months. Danny was known around town as a stand-up man who was a trained scuba diver. To make money, he bought and sold shells throughout the area and frequently did business right in his own front yard. Della was a beautiful and kind young woman who worked at a factory in town. Their remains were found on the couch, indicating to law enforcement that the couple met with foul play before the fire was set. Danny's Rottweiler puppy was also in the home as it burned. The puppy's remains were found in a corner where the poor thing was probably cowering. Bomb and arson investigators inspected the scene with the help of specially trained dogs, and together they identified the scent of an accelerant. According to one of the bomb and arson investigators present at the scene, a marking known as a saddle burn was present near the remnants of the front door, which indicated that the accelerant had been poured in that area. Upon closer inspection and chemical tests, investigators determined that the accelerant was gasoline. They estimated that around 10 gallons of gasoline had been poured inside the home and on the bodies of Danny and Della. Back at the University of Tennessee, a forensic anthropologist identified lead fragments in the skulls of Danny and Della, and after further examination, was able to find part of a bullet still intact in Danny's skull. The bullet belonged to a .38 caliber pistol. This piece of information ruled out the possibility of a murder-suicide. Danny had never owned a .38 caliber pistol, and the weapon was not found within the home. This meant that the young couple were the victims of both a murderer and an arsonist. A couple of miles from where Danny's home used to stand, investigators spotted his red Ford pickup with an empty trailer hitched to it. Upon hearing that the trailer was found empty, Danny's close friends provided police with a possible motive. The previous day, they had seen Danny's trailer filled with about $2,500 worth of mussel shells. After this discovery, the police began working the angle of a robbery gone bad. Tire tracks were found in the dirt road, leading away from Danny's abandoned truck. It looked like a truck had been backed up to Danny's trailer to unload the shells. Investigators hoped that they had made the first big discovery in the case, and the pickup was dusted for fingerprints. To their disappointment, none were found, not even Danny Vine's. The truck had been wiped down and cleaned of any evidence. The list of potential suspects in this case was long. The rough-and-tumble industry of mussel shelling drew an interesting group of workers, those that frequently had multiple felony convictions and didn't shy away from physical work. Law enforcement on the case contacted every business in the Benton County area that bought shells, asking if they had encountered any suspicious sellers in the 2 weeks since the murders and fire. Through this process, the sheriff's department finally made a break in the case. They were informed by a wholesaler near Kentucky, a little over 30 miles from Camden, that they had been sold some mussels that appeared to have lost their water weight and had damaged the outside of the shells. For anyone unfamiliar with mussel shelling, like I was, we did the research for you. A load of mussels that have lost their water weight and have shell damage is a red flag for some buyers, because this usually means that the shells have already been through a shaker. A shaker is used to separate the mussels by size, causing chips on the outside. Both of these characteristics point to stolen shells, as it was unusual for a seller to provide a buyer with a product that had already gone through a shaker. According to the wholesale business that had contacted the sheriff's department, they had been sold the mussels by a woman whose husband worked as a mussel diver. This diver was Gary Bruce. Gary Bruce and his three brothers were notorious in the area and feared by many. This family, made up of four brothers, J.C., age 37, Gary, 36, Jerry Lee, 28, and Robert, 23, along with their mother, Mary Kathleen Bruce, 56, treated Benton County as their own little arena to make a profit or satisfy their grievances. Thanks to their long list of criminal conduct and arrests, the police were not surprised to see one of the brothers' names connected to the case. J.C. Bruce, the oldest of the clan, had been arrested and convicted in the 1974 rape and strangulation of a girl in Waverly, Tennessee. The 15-year-old girl was abducted, raped, and strangled by J.C., then thrown off the side of a bridge where she was left to die. Miraculously, she survived and helped put J.C. behind bars, where he only served a little over 3 years before being pardoned by the disgraced Tennessee governor, Ray Blanton, who infamously took bribes in exchange for handing out pardons. You may remember Governor Blanton from episode 14, The Babysitter Murder. If not, go back and listen to that case for more detail on the Blanton scandals. But back to today's case. This reportedly wasn't the first time a Bruce had avoided the consequences of their actions, and it would not be the last. The family was known for escaping justice by terrorizing and intimidating community members and law enforcement. Gary Bruce, like his brothers, was known for petty crime and threatening witnesses. Law enforcement brought Gary and the other Bruce brothers in for questioning, but their mother, Kathleen, told officers that her sons had been at home all evening the night of the double murder, shooting pool in an outside shed. The brothers denied any involvement in the robbery, arson, and murders. Despite their suspicions, the sheriff's department accepted the alibi for the time and had to release the Bruce brothers. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. For so many of us, the holidays will be different this year. But while we may not be able to enjoy get-togethers with family and friends, that shouldn't stop us from feeling close. That's why I'm giving my loved ones a truly meaningful gift this year, a chance to tell their story and share beloved memories by using StoryWorth. StoryWorth is an online service that helps your loved ones share their memories and personal thoughts. It's a new way to engage with family, especially those you can't see in person. Every week, StoryWorth emails your family member thought-provoking questions like, "What's a small decision you made that ended up changing your life?" "My aunt told me a funny story about how my dad loved to play the Three Stooges when he was a kid. He would mimic the voices and throw himself around their living room, playing every part." Reading these weekly stories is fun and heartwarming. You feel closer to your loved ones, even if you can't be together. After 1 year, StoryWorth will compile all these fun stories and cherished memories into a beautiful keepsake book, complete with photos, that's shipped for free. It's a lovely peek into the past that our children can hand down to their children, keeping family memories alive. Give your loved ones the gift of spending time together wherever you live with StoryWorth. Get started right away with no shipping required by going to storyworth.com/southernfried. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's storyworth.com/southernfried for $10 off. What do you do when you've finished binging a new podcast and you're not ready to start another one? After you've fallen down an internet wormhole, reading everything you can about your latest true crime obsession, your brain is overloaded. It's time for a break. That's when I like to clear more levels on Best Fiends. I love playing Best Fiends when I need to decompress after writing or recording. It's not just a mindless game to pass the time, but a satisfying challenge that helps me get out of my own brain for a while. I have now made it to level 565. My new mission is to beat levels to collect 270 critters to win new prizes. My new fiends are Beau and Eleanor. Best Fiends is boredom's worst nightmare. With over 100 million downloads, players have found this 5-star rated game impossible to put down. If you're like me and love a good challenge, Best Fiends is the game for you. With over 500,000 challenges and new ones added all the time, you'll find yourself saying just one more level every time you play. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Months passed as investigators tried to find new leads in the case. They had a hard time convincing the locals to speak with them, even with a $40,000 reward for information that would lead to an arrest for the murders of Danny and Della. The Benton County Sheriff's Department suspected that any potential witnesses were scared to speak because of the Bruce brothers' reputations. Because of the possibility of witness intimidation and tampering, a federal task force was formed to aid local law enforcement with the investigation. Fortunately, the presence of the task force helped ease the fear of residents of Benton County, and a witness came forward. The woman, unnamed in the reports, told the investigators on the case that she had been with Kathleen Bruce at her home the night of the murders, and that Kathleen's sons were not there, destroying their weak alibi. Another witness, local gas station owner Ralph Sintel Jr., approached law enforcement, further destroying the alibi that the Bruce brothers' mother had crafted for them. According to Sintel, on the night of January 16, 1991, three of the Bruce brothers, Gary, Robert, and Jerry Lee, came to the gas station to fill up 2 5-gallon containers of gasoline. Sintel eventually told the officers that the brothers had paid for the gas, and before leaving, one of them gave a chilling statement. "It's going to be a hot night in Camden tonight." Sintel was not the only witness to provide evidence against the Bruces, but it took the intervention of the federal task force for the residents of Benton County to come forward with their stories and testimony. The circumstantial evidence and witness statements against the Bruce brothers began piling up, and the Bruce family became spooked. At this point, the investigators assigned to the murders had spent over a year trying to make a case against their suspects, the Bruce brothers, and their neighbor and friend, David Riles. A man named John Norrell had seen David Riles speeding away from the crime scene in Danny Vine's pickup truck, which was found by investigators. But Norrell did not come forward until a year after the murders in fear of the Bruce family. He claimed that he had heard about people being murdered and threatened. So far, one of the brothers, J.C. Bruce, had not been linked to the crime at all. In an effort to determine if he was involved, TBI Special Agent Alvin Daniel and Benton County Sheriff Billy Wyatt convinced a former girlfriend of J.C.'s, Sheila Bradford, to meet with them on September 18, 1992. They hoped that Sheila, who had up until very recently been living with J.C., would be able to implicate him in the double murder. As the meeting started, a building located next to the restaurant they were at exploded, ending Sheila's interview. The investigators suspected that the Bruce brothers had orchestrated the explosion to keep Sheila from speaking with them. Sheila's 15-year-old daughter, Christy, had been at the restaurant during the meeting between her mother and the officers. She remembers her mother pushing her to the floor when the building exploded and then ushering her out of the restaurant, deathly afraid. Sheila sent Christy to stay at her father's house for her safety, and she went to her sister's. 3 days after Sheila's ill-fated meeting with the Benton County Sheriff and TBI agent, on September 21, 1992, the 33-year-old mother went missing. According to a newspaper brief by the Jackson Sun, Sheila planned to deposit $700 in the bank that morning while she was waiting for her clothes to dry at her sister's home. But when family realized she had not come home, they suspected foul play. The pants she had hung up to dry in preparation for her meeting that morning were still hanging in her sister's house. She was last seen at 8 a.m. that morning, wearing a teal top and underwear. Sheila Bradford has not been seen since that September morning in 1992. And police suspect that she was murdered by the Bruce brothers in an attempt to keep her quiet. However, Sheila's daughter said at the time her mother went missing, despite their suspicions, the Benton County Sheriff and TBI did not really investigate her mother's disappearance. I will come back to this later, but considering the task force formed for this case, it is extremely unusual and disheartening that officials did not help Sheila's family more at the time. But back to the timeline, law enforcement had more witness issues. Despite the damning details of gas station owner Sintel's witness statement, forensics could not place the Bruce brothers at the scene of the crime. The brothers denied ever owning a .38 caliber pistol. The bullet, found by the forensic scientist, and burn patterns on Danny's skull told investigators that Danny had been shot and then fell forward with his face on the sofa. This position allowed less heat and flames to reach Danny's head and caused the bullet to stay intact enough for police to use for comparison. But they didn't have anything to compare the ballistics to. That is, until an old friend of Gary's provided law enforcement with the breakthrough they needed. According to the unknown woman, she had been on Gary's property one day when he took out a .38 revolver. Gary began practicing his shot, using a tree as a target. The woman led officers to the tree, where sure enough, they were able to pull a .38 caliber round for comparison to the bullet found in Danny's skull. A ballistics expert at the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation analyzed the two bullets, and the striation marks matched up perfectly. The bullets had come from the same weapon. This evidence was critical. It forensically linked Gary Bruce to the scene of the crime. David Riles and Gary, Robert, and Jerry Lee Bruce were arrested and charged with two counts of first-degree murder. While there were rumors spreading through the town that the Bruce brothers and David Riles were the main suspects in the double murder, Danny Vine's mother, Carol, was still shocked to learn that the four had been arrested and were facing federal charges of robbery, murder, and arson on November 2, 1993. This was almost 3 years after Danny and Della were murdered. When she heard the name Jerry Lee Bruce, she realized that Della had mentioned him to her a few weeks before she was murdered. Jerry Lee had attempted to persuade Della to go on a date with him, to which Della said no and reportedly replied, "You'll never be half the man that Danny is." Their mother, Kathleen Bruce, was also arrested and charged with perjury and obstruction of justice for providing the police with a false alibi for her sons. The brothers and David Riles awaited trial at the newly built McNary County Jail in Selmer, Tennessee. The family attempted to fight for a bond, but the judge denied their requests after Jerry Lee threatened a Benton County sheriff, saying that he would murder the sheriff and his family. Before one hearing for Gary Bruce, a bomb threat was called into the courthouse and the hearing was postponed. While in jail, Gary and Jerry Lee Bruce became friends with fellow inmate James McGrogan, who called himself a self-appointed inmate lawyer. Essentially, McGrogan liked to help other inmates with preparing for their trials. Gary and Jerry Lee bragged to McGrogan about their tactics to harass and intimidate anyone in Benton County that tried to come forward to the police. Gary told McGrogan that nobody was supposed to interfere with them or their family, and that if any witnesses testified against them, they would be sorry. The brothers also described their hope that members of their family on the outside would frighten anyone who helped the Benton County Sheriff's Department. McGrogan provided all of this information to police, not to help himself, he said, but for what he called moral reasons. On July 27, 1994, Gary Bruce told McGrogan, quote, "There wouldn't be any witnesses or their fucking families left." Hours later, he and three other inmates, though none of them members of his family, escaped from the McNary County Jail. Gary and the other three inmates, two of which also faced charges of murder, and another man facing time for aggravated assault, climbed through a hole in the fence in the outdoor exercise yard. By August 1st, Gary's three fellow escapees had been apprehended, while the Bruce brother remained on the lam. Over the next few months, police confirmed sightings of Gary in several cities, including locations across Decatur, Carroll, and Benton counties. United States District Judge James Todd told newspapers that Gary could not be tried until he was found and brought back to the jail. This meant that the others involved in the case would have to be tried without Gary. The federal trial of David Riles and Jerry Lee, Robert, and Kathleen Bruce lasted 3 weeks. On July 17, 1995, after just over 6 hours of deliberation, the jury found David Riles, Jerry Lee, and Robert Bruce guilty of the murders of Danny Vine and Della Thornton. Mary Kathleen Bruce was found guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice. Jerry Lee and Robert Bruce were sentenced to life in prison, without the possibility of parole, while their mother was sentenced to serve 97 months. David Riles was sentenced the following day, also receiving a life sentence, without the possibility of parole. Moments after his sentence was laid out by Judge James Todd, Riles turned to the families of the murder victims and stated, quote, "If you will get in touch with my attorney, I will talk to you." Carol Vine told reporters she was shocked by the killer's statement, while Nell Thornton, Della's mother, said she was willing to speak with him. But it is unclear if Riles ever made good on his claim. While his brother's friend and mother were awaiting and going through their trials, Gary Bruce remained a free man. After sightings of Gary dried up, law enforcement had trouble finding any trace of the accused murderer. Gary even made the FBI's 10 most wanted list, but he still managed to elude police. By January of 1995, Gary had made his way to Nashville, Tennessee. He had stolen the identity of a man named Glenn Barton, and even managed to get a new license and other documentation to further his ruse. After hiding out for several months, Gary had altered his appearance. His once short dark hair was now down to his shoulders and blonde. He no longer sported a mustache and had grown quite skinny. Gary adopted the persona of Glenn Barton and got a job at a service station in the Mona Drive area of Nashville, where he set up his new life. Following an anonymous tip, investigators captured Jerry on September 22, 1995, in Nashville. At first, they struggled to find similarities between the accused murderer Gary Bruce and the man they had apprehended, named Glenn. Apparently, Gary was very good at altering his appearance. It wasn't until officers compared the signature on Glenn's license to that of Gary's that the investigators believed they had their man. Gary had spent 14 months free as a fugitive of the law. Once his trial began, Gary claimed that he had nothing to do with the murders on the night of January 16, 1991. He claimed that he believed his brothers, Jerry Lee and Robert, were involved, but this weak attempt to throw his own blood under the bus didn't work. It only took the jury 2 hours to find Gary Bruce guilty of all charges. He was then sentenced, just like his brothers, to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Della Thornton's father, Mac Thornton, died the day of Gary's guilty verdict. I hope he found peace, knowing that the last of those involved in his daughter and future and son-in-law's deaths was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. Throughout the course of the trials, prosecutors argued that robbery was the primary motive. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Steve Parker and Jennifer Weber described how, at a party the day before the murders, the three Bruce brothers concocted their plan to rob Danny Vine of his muscle shells, rather than making the effort to go out into the biting winter and do the work themselves. Shockingly, the host of the party, Patricia Odom, and several other guests at the event overheard the Bruce brothers' plan. Several were even propositioned to join in. In the early months of the investigation, Patricia kept quiet about the events at her party. But even still, weird things began to happen around her property, and they didn't stop until her boyfriend confronted the brothers. Many of the partygoers, including Odom and the Bruce brothers' first cousin, Ira Travis, feared for their lives and did not provide law enforcement with these details until the federal task force got involved. Another victim of the Bruce family's intimidation, Tammy Rayburn, was a former girlfriend of Robert Bruce. Robert offered Tammy money in exchange with providing him an alibi for the murders. Tammy rejected the offer, but remained quiet out of fear. Her silence did not protect her, though. She was stalked for months by the Bruce matriarch, Kathleen. Tammy later told police that she feared for her and her family's lives, and that Kathleen Bruce would sit outside next to her home at all hours of the day and night. The terrorizing of Benton County didn't stop there. As I told you, the witness, John Norell, who saw David Riles speeding away from Danny Vine's home in Danny's pickup the night of the murders, did not come forward for over a year because he had been intimidated by the rumors. Shannon Irwin, who was dating Robert Bruce at the time of the murders but eventually married Jerry Lee Bruce, was stalked by Kathleen as well. Gary Bruce reportedly told Shannon that he could kill her and her mother right there and never have the act on his conscience. The families of the victims were also tormented by the Bruce family. Larry Vine was run off the road by the Bruce brothers. And whenever he was spotted around Camden, the Bruce family would make obscene gestures at him. Special Agent Alvin Daniel, who was being treated for cancer during the later years of the investigation, was threatened specifically by Gary Bruce. These details unfolded throughout the course of the trial, as witnesses provided testimony against the Bruces. According to the prosecutors, on the night of the murders, the three Bruce brothers and David Riles filled up plastic containers of gasoline at Ralph Sentel Jr.'s gas station before heading to Danny Vine's home. It is suspected that when they arrived, Danny was home alone with his Rottweiler puppy. The brothers and Riles robbed Danny of the cash he had on hand. When Della arrived, it is assumed she noticed the truck belonging to the Bruce brothers parked in Danny's driveway, and she ran into the home to help Danny. It is then theorized that Gary Bruce tied up Danny and Della and then shot Danny in the head with his .38 caliber pistol. Then he handed Jerry Lee the gun, who proceeded to execute Della in the same way. The group then poured gasoline all around the house and Danny and Della's bodies before setting the fire. Riles drove Danny's pickup to a street out of sight, where the Bruce brothers met up with him and transferred the $2,500 worth of shells into their own truck. The group wiped down Danny's pickup to rid the truck of any fingerprints and sold the shells to a buyer in the days following the murders. The Bruce brothers did not realize they had made two major mistakes. First, they had executed Danny in a way that left the crucial piece of forensic evidence tying them to the case intact, the unmelted bullet. Second, they either didn't realize or didn't care that Danny had already put the shells through a shaker, which raised a red flag for the wholesale buyer near Kentucky that Gary Bruce's wife had sold the muscles to. Finally, after the convictions, the community of Benton County could breathe a sigh of relief. Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen Parker said, quote, "A lot of people were very happy. It lowered the crime rate significantly in Benton County and the area." These days, the Bruce brothers continue to make appeals for their case. The most recent appeal, by Gary Bruce in 2016, argued that there was not enough witness intimidation to grant federal involvement in the case, and therefore, the trial should not have been tried federally. This appeal, like all of the others, has been denied. In 2010, David Riles wrote a blog declaring his innocence and asking the public for help. According to Riles, he had nothing to do with the murders of Danny and Della. And he insists that the witnesses who placed him at the scene and speeding away from the crime that night were under the sway of federal prosecutors. Also, his girlfriend at the time and a neighbor testified in court as alibi witnesses for him. The only evidence against Riles is the eyewitness testimony of John Norrell. Riles claims that he made U.S. Attorney Steve Parker mad when he refused to be interviewed about the case. It's also worth noting that the only other witness against Riles was a jailhouse informant, who claimed David said he was there that night. He also pointed out that John Norrell and his brother were also in the mussel harvesting business, perhaps hinting at a rivalry. And he further claims that Norrell was trying to cash in on the reward money offered in Danny and Della's murders. David Riles remains in jail today. His attorney removed himself from the case after his first failed appeal. "I'm not really sure what to make of Riles. It's true that there was no physical evidence tying him to the murders, only eyewitness testimony. And he's not the only question mark in this case. Through our research, we came to learn that there were actually seven Bruce brothers. Not much is known about all of them besides rumors on the internet. It's almost impossible to guess how far the Bruce family's influence reached. J.C. Bruce, the oldest of the brothers and the ex-boyfriend of Sheila Bradford, who remains missing, has had many run-ins with the law since his brother's convictions. In the year 2000, J.C. was convicted of assault, followed by a conviction of paddlefish poaching twice, once in 2009 and again in 2010. Most recently, he was arrested in 2015 for illegally attempting to poach paddlefish in Cheatham and Dixon counties in Tennessee. But according to the Farrier Files from Fox 17 out of Nashville, as of 2018, J.C. still lived in the area. The Bruce family wreaked havoc throughout several Tennessee cities and counties, and the brothers truly believed they would get away with their crimes, including the cold and brutal slayings of Danny Vine and Della Jean Thornton. Despite their convictions, the depraved actions of the Bruce family and their accomplice, David Riles, has left a lasting impact on the Vine and Thornton families. Nell and Mac Thornton lost their daughter and future son-in-law. Carol and Larry Vine suffered the loss of their son and future daughter-in-law that night in January of 1991. Carol Vine told the media, quote, "They did this for money, but it took my child and the Thornton's daughter. It took any future grandchildren that we could have had." And adding further cruelty, a gravestone photograph of Danny and Della worth $500 was stolen from the cemetery. It was eventually recovered at a grocery store in good shape. But you have to wonder, who other than the Bruce family would have motive for such a hateful crime against Danny and Della's families? Was it further intimidation, or was it stolen out of just cold-blooded meanness? Countless Benton County residents lived their lives in fear of the power that the Bruce brothers held over them, and even the sheriff's department. Sheila Bradford's daughter, Christy Bradford, was at the meeting in 1992 when her mother pleaded with law enforcement to help her, days before she went missing. Christy, her siblings, and the other members of the Bradford family still live with the agony of not knowing what happened to Sheila 28 years later. Christy told Dennis Farrier of Fox News that she lived at a secret location and did not own anything in her own name. She also said that the police at the time initially refused to open a missing persons report on her mother, despite the meeting where she specifically told the sheriff and a TBI agent that she feared for her life. Christy told the Jackson Sun that law enforcement did little to nothing to find her mother. Quote, "They came, took our statements, took some pictures at my aunt's house, and said they'd let us know if they heard or found anything. If they ever actively looked for her, I never knew of it." She went on to say, quote, "For years, I would ask for something new, and if I was given any answer, it was that they'd heard nothing. TBI, the sheriff's office, none of them know anything. There's not even a file on Mama at the sheriff's department." The current district attorney said, quote, "Today, in part, because of the Sheila Bradford case, we do things differently when we meet with witnesses. Folks didn't realize how sophisticated crime can be in a rural area." Christy was 15 years old at the time, but she remembered her mother's despair as the officers refused to help her, telling Sheila she didn't have enough information for them to offer protection, shortly before the building behind the restaurant exploded. She said her mother threw her to the floor and said, "He knows we are here. We must leave." Christy said after this failed meeting, her mother wanted to get clothes together before she went back into hiding, and she sent her daughter to stay with her dad. Christy told Dennis Farrier, quote, "She just disappeared off the face of the earth. There was no trace, nothing. Her car was sitting in the driveway. Her clothes were still in the dryer. She didn't even have her shoes." Even though the DA eventually opened a case on Sheila Bradford, it is cold comfort to her family as their mother's ex-boyfriend, J.C. Bruce, still roams free. Christy clearly still fears for her own life as she grieves for her long-missing mother. I found this part of the story strange and confusing, considering the task force and how much officials knew about the intimidation by the Bruce family. The only thing I read in this case that stuck out to me was that both the Benton County Sheriff and the TBI agent who met with Sheila died before the Bruce family and Riles went to trial. Perhaps without their direct influence, Sheila's case fell through the cracks as the police and TBI were just relieved to have the Bruce brothers and their accomplice, David Riles, behind bars. Christy Bradford went into law enforcement herself 10 years after her mother went missing, working as a dispatcher for the Carroll County Sheriff's Department. She told the Jackson Sun, quote, "I wanted to do something that could help others. I wanted to make sure that when someone calls 911 and they're going through one of the worst experiences of their life, that the person on the other end of the line that answers the call cares as much as I wanted someone to care about Mama." This past October, a $10,000 reward for information about Sheila's disappearance was offered by the TBI, something the district attorney and Christy are grateful for after all these years. If you have any information about Sheila Bradford, please contact the TBI at 1-800-TBI-FIND. It is unimaginable that Danny and Della were murdered for a measly $2,500. Their lives and Sheila Bradford's life were worth more than any amount of money. I am happy that the Vine and Thornton families got justice for the loss of their loved ones, but their grief is immeasurable. And my heart aches for Christy Bradford and her family. There is nothing worse than not knowing, especially when that son of a bitch, J.C. Bruce, still walks free. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional research, writing, and editing by me. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to listener Ashley Hubbs for suggesting this interesting case. Thanks again to all of you who reached out to me in concern the last few months, and I want to thank my husband, who has been my full-time caregiver, while still running his business. It's been a rough time, and he has brought me through this tirelessly with so much positivity and love. As a reminder, I do still have one more back surgery to go. I will produce episodes as long as I can until the surgery, and hopefully after the new year, my schedule will go back to normal. Make sure you follow me on social media or check my website for updates. And please, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and our motto is, "No shitasses allowed." If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.